Well, as a couple of inches of snow piles up silently here in America's heartland, I'm reminded of a couple of things. First of all, that Vancouver would love to have the snow we're getting. They're like cursed when it comes to the weather in Vancouver, although apparently they've been holding it together just enough for the Winter Olympics. But here in the upper Midwest, this recent slathering of snow reminds us that there are clues that are waiting for the spring thaw, clues to a series of murders that many people feel strongly have been taking place. Overall, across the country, there's been over 100 disappearances of college-age men who fall into the same category. They would be considered successful young men, good-looking students, who, at least for a period of the last evening of their life, had gone out drinking. And not ridiculous kinds of, stories, pretty typical sort of drinking episodes. And then somehow were never heard from again. Many of them have been found weeks, sometimes months later, sometimes sadly after a spring thaw, and they were found along or in various rivers along the I-94 corridor. I-94 being a major highway that runs all the way to the East Coast, and there were some clues at the very beginning at these scenes where the bodies were found or where these boys were last seen going into the water. Or were they the last time somebody found any evidence of them, like, some shoes or something that was that linked to them right at the shoreline, and that coincidental image was of a smiley face. And some people started to say that there was a connection between all of these deaths, and that the smiley face killers, as they were began to be called, might be some sort of cult. That was going around, and they were capturing college-age guys who were inebriated, and then they were holding them for a period of time, for varying degrees of perhaps sexual torture, or at very least just capture, and then they were drowning them along the river. In almost every case, these deaths have been ruled either an accidental drowning or intentional suicide. And they were all tied to the alcohol that that person was drinking that night. That's why nobody knew about it. That's why there was no suicide note. That it came about sort of spontaneously after the alcohol consumption on the last night of their life. But there were other people out there, including two retired police detectives, or one police detective, one retired police officer from New York, who hit the case anew, and they came up with these connections. And they tried to get the federal government involved to look at it as a national police agency like the FBI would, and they were rebuffed at every opportunity. And in the past, we've enjoyed the conversation as much as a conversation like that can be enjoyed, with a reporter from a TV station in the Twin Cities who left her job, who'd been on Good Morning America after she was on the show too, at talking about the evidence that was left at the scene, the trouble getting police to investigate them as something other than a suicide or an accidental drowning, and the possibility that there was some sort of connection through the graffiti. Well, so many of you have asked for an update that I asked Christy Peel if she would come back. And she's coming back tonight, not just as a reporter that's now turned investigator. I mean, she was investigating it as a reporter, but now she realizes it's just her mission. And so she's going to go through all the files herself, along with the help of some people who she was able to enlist, like a medical examiner who will join us during the show and talk about how they're getting this wrong in Michigan, and how, in her opinion, and in the evidence that she's seeing, there is a strong case to be made for at least a malevolent hand in the death of many of these young men, maybe not all 100 tied together, but enough that when you look at it for where the investigation stands right now, that the FBI has to get involved. We'll tell you more about that. We'll talk about the evidence. We'll talk about the jurisdiction in Michigan that is refusing to investigate this. We'll have the medical examiner on the phone with us tonight, who will talk about the difference between what the local coroner determined about this missing boy's eventual death and what she knows to be the truth about what happened to him for the days that he went missing. And we'll get into all of that coming up next on Coast to Coast. This is Ian Punnett. Well, I think I got the setup right. We'll check on some of those details, but I know that throughout the evening, what you're going to hear tonight on Coast to Coast is a story that almost seems too bizarre to be true, and yet almost a story that falls along some pretty predictable lines. That is to say that there are elements to this story that'll just make you nod your head and you think, well, here we go again. A case where men are disappearing on college campuses, and nobody seems all that concerned about it. The charge has been made from the very beginning that if these were women that were missing, if these were women who were gone for, 10, 15, 20, 30 days, there would be a much greater uproar. There would be people would somehow be more open to the idea that there is a serial killer on the loose here in the United States. Because they're men, there just doesn't seem to be the interest level within the police authorities. It doesn't seem to have the same, it doesn't seem to raise the same alarms that these cases would if they were women. Christy Peel used to be a reporter for 5 Eyewitness News and has continued to investigate what we have, for lack of a better term, we've been calling it the smiley face killers. But, and thank you, Christy, for giving us time on this tonight. You're beginning to feel like almost like the smiley face killer angle, the graffiti angle of the story, may have been kind of a red herring and something that kept police authorities from investigating.
Yeah, good evening. It's funny because I think the public has grasped onto the smiley face killer's name and image, but I think that in law enforcement circles, it has done negative things for this story and has just perpetuated it as a conspiracy and not as something that is factual.
Okay, explain how the smiley face killer angle started and why you don't think that's the way we should continue to talk about it.
Well, and the bummer in all this is that I blame myself because I was working at KSTP in Minneapolis, and we had been working for quite some time with 2 former detectives, police officers in New York City, who were convinced that these drowning deaths were connected. And when we pressed them for some evidence to show that they were connected, they brought to us the smiley face graffiti that they said they could find at these different locations. And that's what we went with when we told the story in Minneapolis and on your show and on Good Morning America. And that's kind of the title, the name of it, that stuck. Now, the problem is that these smiley face graffiti images are everywhere. We all see them. And law enforcement, that's not proof. You're not going to take an image of graffiti to a courtroom. You're not going to tie it to someone and then tie that same person to a homicide. I mean, I guess you could, but right, it's a little bit more difficult than actual hard factual evidence.
Now, there were some things that were unique about this, about the spray painting that was going on at some of the scenes of where these men went into the water, were presumed to go into water, or where they were found. And one of those had to do with a word that was spray painted. It was in Michigan, wasn't it, that was spray painted that tied to a guy who was missing in Iowa?
That's right. Yes. Incinua.
Mm-hmm. And explain that. I mean, that does seem really, that of all of the, I mean, spray painting, smiley faces, you're right, they're ubiquitous. So how can you begin to say, well, this was tied to this or that? I mean, they're everywhere. People, that's just the most easy. It's almost like you warm up your night of graffiti. You warm up your can by doing a smiley face. That's how you know your can of spray paint is working, is do a smiley face. So they are everywhere. But this Sinowa thing, that was an odd sort of coincidence. Explain what happened in that case.
Well, this was from the two New York former officers. They said that they were at a scene of a death in Michigan and that they found the word Sinowa. And they wondered what that meant, and they thought it was quite odd. And then they were in Iowa several months later looking at a death there and found that the road that ran right next to the river was Sinowa. Now, you know, we reported that. I have not seen an image of that Sinowa. I'm not saying it doesn't exist at all. I'm just saying that I haven't seen it. And that's something that they base some of their theories on.
Now, it's important then to point out, too, that these two particular police detectives ran into some credibility issues when they took this case, and I know I personally walked this case into the hands of a former FBI profiler and asked him to look at it, and other people that I knew to look at it and say, what do you see? What do you hear in this? Is there any truth to this? And the some of the pushback that came out about these retired police officers is that they had run out of money to investigate this on their own, that they were looking to be supported in the furthering of this investigation. That may not be an unreasonable claim, but it helped to complicate their public image. And you have since decided not to continue to work with them?
That's right. I haven't talked with them for about 18 months. The families that I talk with and the people that I have aligned myself with now don't have any conversations with either of those former officers.
But you are continuing this investigation. Why?
You know, I had seen things along the way that really convinced me that there is something going on. And if I have that kind of information and if I do nothing, then I think that I'm as guilty as the people committing the crimes.
And in this case, what you're saying is you see a connection between at least some of these 100 and some odd files of college age men who had one more night of college age fun before they were found dead in or around a river.
You know, the disturbing connections that I'm seeing are connections of injustice, of unfair investigation, and of the families have been treated similarly. It's difficult for them, and they don't have an advocate. They don't have anyone listening to them. And I don't know how it happened, but I became that person.
Yeah, that's called destiny. You as now as the advocate for the families of these, in some cases, still missing men, but in other cases, known where the bodies have been examined by the local coroner, and the coroner determined that this was either a suicide or accidental drowning, and the family is saying, that's not possible, that's not my son, look at the terrain in which he disappeared, there's no way he could have fallen in. He had everything to live for. There were no signs of suicide. I mean, the families are making the cases, but they're falling on deaf ears.
Right, and I don't know why it's like this, but when a family of a missing child says, hey, my kid wouldn't do that, for some reason, some investigators write them off or don't want to hear it. And that's unfortunate because a lot of times these people, they know their children better than anyone else. And if they say, hey, my son would not run off with a hooker like you're telling me he did, the police brush them off and don't start looking for them. And that has happened in more than one case where that's what the parents were told.
Okay, and there was no evidence that he ran off with a hooker.
No evidence, except, you know, young men, they get drunk, they disappear, he'll be back, just bear with us.
And then they don't come back or their bodies are found later on in the river.
That's right.
Okay. How many men, I mean, as you look at the case, I know that, you know, the investigation went pretty wide there for a while, and lots of numbers were bandied about. What do you think is the current number that you believe may indicate one person or a group of similarly inclined people working together may be responsible for? What percentage of that original file of over 100? What's the number now you think we should be looking at in terms of how many of these cases are connected?
You know, I think that there are 80 people who fit the profile with unexplained circumstances. I can't answer how many have been killed or how many have been killed by the same people. I think that we need to go one at a time to figure that out. And honestly, I'm a trained journalist. You know, I was trained to ask questions, and when I don't have answers, go find people who have the answers. And law enforcement is going to have to get involved to answer that question. That isn't something that anyone without a badge, without subpoena power, can do.
But you've worked with people who have the background in law enforcement, like this medical examiner we're going to be talking about tonight. Can you tell us more about her?
It's Dr. Michael Sicarica. It's a him.
Oh, him, sorry.
That's all right. It all started about a year ago when I knew I was actually researching for a book. Someone wanted me to write a book, and I wanted to continue to tell the victim stories, and a book made sense. But in that research for that book, I realized that there were some things that didn't make sense in a certain case in Michigan, and I don't have the expertise to get the answers. So I turned to a former district attorney in New York, Trisha Angeles, who was fantastic. She reviewed the case with me. She had been involved was very familiar with these cases, and took that information to Dr. Michael Sicarica, because Trisha and I don't have, we aren't experts in this field, but he is, and said, look at this. Here's some of the things that we think are a little bit off. We don't have any expertise. Tell us what you think. And part of what I then did is I went in and interviewed some of the people over the phone, people who found his body, and asked them questions, and then handed that information over to Trish. So that was kind of how all three of us were involved in this situation.
Okay. Trish was the one I was thinking of when we were talking about it. So of the cases that you have, how many of them have been reviewed now by somebody other than the original investigating authority, local authority, where the college boy went missing?
There are several that have been done on a small scale. We have one that has been done from start to finish, all the way through, taking it to law enforcement and gotten an answer from them. That is a long process. So, I mean, we're trying to do this very slow, but
sure.
We have one that's gone from start to finish with an answer to law enforcement. Because one of the things that I'm that I believe strongly in is that we shouldn't be taking this information to the public before taking it to law enforcement. So the reason we're talking about this now is because we did take it to law enforcement, we did get an answer, and now we need action.
And in this case, then, in just a few minutes, we'll be joined here in the conversation by the forensic pathologist who examined this one case. And this is the case of somebody who was missing in Michigan. And when the local coroner looked at the body, they said what? What was the determination made in the police report and on the death certificate?
Accidental drowning. And that determination was made before the toxicology report was back. That's a commonality that we find in a lot of these, where really all the information isn't back and the family and the public is told accidental. So in this case, it was an accidental drowning, and it was based on his blood alcohol level, and the case was closed.
Can you tell us real quickly about the case we're just about to hear about?
Sure. The victim in this case is Todd Geib. He was 22 years old. He was last seen at a party in an orchard in Muskegon County, Michigan, on June 12, 2005. He lived about a mile away from this outdoor party and decided that he would walk home. He was very familiar with the area. He was an amazing swimmer. The place he was living at the time had a lake in the backyard. He was supposed to just walk home, nothing out of the ordinary. People who were at that party said that he had been drinking, but that he didn't appear heavily intoxicated. And it wasn't the first time the guy had been at a party. So he wasn't unfamiliar with alcohol.
Right.
He, during that time, called someone, and the friend of his who he called said that she couldn't understand what he was saying, that it sounded like wind. At one point, he said he was in a field. Then no one hears from him for all this time. 20 days later, they find him in a lake about a quarter of a mile from the party, opposite direction of his house.
And 20 days later, in an opposite direction from his house, they find his body in the lake, and the local coroner determined that he drowned that night.
Yes.
Okay, and that would have meant that the body had been in the water for 20 days. And the medical examiner, the former forensic investigator, our current forensic pathologist that we're about to talk to said what? What was his conclusion? We have about 30 seconds.
That he was dead no more than 5 days. Dr. Sikorica took that information, got it in the hands of 200 other medical examiners who agree that he couldn't have been dead for more than a few days. So
all right.
Where was he?
Then where was he? And that brings us back to, again, is there somebody out there that's capturing these young men, holding them for a period of time, and then drowning them later? And nobody's investigating other than Christy Peel. We'll talk to her coming up next on Coast to Coast. This is Ian Punnett. I think the link up is still there at coasttocoastam.com for my blog, but I didn't put anything fresh up tonight. Just had too many things going on this weekend. But a couple of thoughts about werewolves from last night, if you want to grab that. More specifically about the new Benicio del Toro movie about the Wolfman. And then also link up last night through Streamlink to the show with Andrew Zimmern. He's the guy on the Travel Channel who does the show Bizarre Foods, who flies all over the world and visits indigenous cultures and eats the most disgusting crud you can possibly believe. However, he learns a lot along the way, and the shows are very entertaining as he, finds out what people eat and why, and then he samples it, even though some of the things he's eaten are some of the most disgusting things you could possibly imagine. He described one dish that he had to try to sit through as tofu soaked in the fluid that sits at the bottom of dumpsters. But it's a popular dish somewhere, and he struggled through it. And even in the zone in here in the United States, in some regions like Mississippi, Appalachia, even up in Maine and L.A. and Alaska, there are these very bizarre foods even here in this country. And Andrew had a very entertaining first 2 hours. And then after that was a book about the body language that we could all learn from, the Body Language Handbook. And I really enjoyed Gregory Hartley, former U.S. interrogator for the military, who is an expert in body language and how to read the people who are being interrogated. That might come in handy here sometime. When it comes to the so-called smiley face killer story, if we can get a suspect, it will be a day when perhaps we can finally get insight into what's happening to these young men, these young college-age men who, along the corridor of I-94, seemingly on other side of this highway corridor that stretches all across from the upper Midwest all the way to the East Coast, young college-age men are going missing, and then when they're found, it just seems like the pattern is it's determined that it was accidental drowning or suicide, until people like our next guest, Dr. Michael Sikorica, takes a look at the case. And we'll pick up the story coming up next with Christy Peel, the former reporter who is still acting as the lead investigator in this case, trying to find a fresh look from police authorities on this cold case next on Coast to Coast. This is Ian Punnett. We're getting an update on something that you all have asked about now over the last couple of months. People have either emailed in or called when we were doing open line segments and said, what's the latest you've been hearing about the smiley face killer story? So we talked earlier with Christy Peel, who said she kind of regrets in a way that the story got badged the smiley face killers, because we really don't know that it has anything to do with the graffiti. What we do know is that there's a profile of these men who go missing, who are later found dead. And part of that profile is, unfortunately, that the police authorities that investigate when the bodies are found come to a very early and, it seems like, stubborn conclusion that, despite evidence or family testimony to the contrary, that these guys merely accidentally drowned or they committed suicide. So enters Dr. Michael Sikorica. He's with the Forensic Identification and Profiling Laboratory, which is in New York, where they, as it says on your website here, Dr. Sikorica, you provide quality, customized, and timely forensic identity consultation and educational outreach. I'm guessing that means that you pick up the slack a lot for investigating authorities that need the lab help, and or you do work for people who are in the private sector who need a lab like yours to do forensic identification. Is that accurate?
Yes, Ian. It's actually only part of what I do. My major role is as a forensic pathologist. The laboratory was created several years ago to sort of fill in the gap with some laboratory services that could be useful to the community and to law enforcement and even the defense community if they need it. My primary job, though, is being a forensic pathologist and doing forensic cases. I do between 500 and 600 autopsies a year and travel quite a ways in the upstate New York area doing these cases.
Now, are you brought in then by, say, a local county, an attorney general? Who brings you in to do the pathology?
Well, I am a county medical examiner in one of the counties up here in New York, but I also do contractual work with about 15 other counties. So I travel and I work for the county coroners and sometimes the county medical examiners.
Do you remember how you got involved in this case originally with Christy Peel?
Yes. The case was brought to me last spring by Trish DeAngelis, who was very interested in the case and just asked me to take a look at it. And I received very preliminary report material, a very hard-to-read autopsy report, a few pictures, and I was really taken aback by the pictures primarily of Todd and the circumstances, which I came to understand a little bit more later on.
But Christy and I were just talking about that. And Christy, you can jump in anywhere along the line here to make sure that the story gets furthered in a clear manner. But as we were talking about, then you got this preliminary report that said this guy had been in the water. The local ME had determined that he was this missing college guy had been in the water for 21 days. Was it, Christy, a total?
Yes, he was last seen June 12th, and he was recovered July 2nd.
So what did you see right away, Dr. Sikorica, that made you raise an eyebrow that maybe this report wasn't getting the full story?
Well, without being too graphic, the degree of decomposition, the natural changes that occur after death, did not appear consistent with someone who'd been missing in the water for 3 weeks. It was surprisingly sparse. Even at reading the autopsy report, the description of the internal organs and such really appeared to be a person had been in the water 3 to 5 days at the most.
Does temperature have anything to do with that? I mean, could the local medical examiner have had more information about the temperature of the water that might have prevented the body from decomposing in the manner that you would have expected?
Yes, that is a possibility. This small lake that he was found in was relatively shallow. He was found July, the early part of July, I believe, on the 2nd, and missing for 3 weeks in June. There could be some temperature effect on this, but I think that would behoove them to explain it, how that would work.
It would have to have been a kind of a sudden freak cold front or something that kept the water extra cold during that period or something.
That would be one way to explain it, perhaps a very cold temperature in the lake itself, underground springs or something like that. But it doesn't appear that there's any explanation for it.
And so,
can I jump in for a second?
Please do.
The man who found Todd is a diver, actually, and it was a private lake. And I talked with him initially, and that was one of the most fascinating conversations. And that's kind of when I took it to Trish and said, we need help here. Because he'd explained the shape of that lake is kind of like almost like a hook. And if you look at it like an upside down J, and at the bottom of the longer part of it, of the J, is where would have been the closest location to the party, and that's where the police determined that Todd would have entered that water. And it's very rugged and the terrain is difficult around there. And they never found footprints or anything. But what this diver and the man who found him said was so odd is that Todd was found kind of on the tip of the J. And that means that he would have had to go through what they call there the Narrows, and it's very shallow and very, there would be very difficult to get through. He said he had trouble with his boat, and he can't imagine how a body could get through, and he described that water as being warm, and so he was very shocked that Todd would have been found there, especially when he was in that water very frequently during the time Todd was missing, and then he never saw him, and then one day he went out, and there was Todd on this far section. So that water is one of the reasons that, you know, Trish and I thought, okay, we need help here because something doesn't fit. But I just thought that water piece would help you.
Yeah, it does help. And so no indication that there's any huge variance in the temperature. And in fact, it's hard to imagine that the body would have traveled from a point where the local police report determined that he went in at the bottom of an upside down J and is found having traveled a great distance and found somewhere else, and supposedly having been in the water for that entire time. Dr. Michael Sikorica, you look at did you ever have a chance to examine the body itself?
No, I haven't. I've only worked off the report, the police investigation materials, and the photograph.
But based on your reputation and your experience, you make a determination that says this guy could only have been in the water for 3 to 5 days. Which says, then it begs the question, where had the body been? Where had the guy been? Now, do you determine that the body had only been in the water for 3 to 5 days, or that he had only been dead for 3 to 5 days? Dr. Sikorica?
Yes. I would say that he appears to have been deceased for 3 to 5 days, and most likely had been alive prior to being placed into that water. There's no indication or no way that I can actually say his condition prior to being put in the water, but he had probably been in that water for 3 to 5 days at the most.
So the conclusion in your report is that the local medical examiner, perhaps well-intentioned, is just flat-out wrong.
Well, he never made a real assumption of how long Todd had been in that water. That's not a part of his report. He assumed that the cause and manner of death, the cause being drowning, the manner being accidental, that was his job. And nowhere in his report does he really state that, there's a discrepancy between the appearance of Todd and the suspected time frame of him being missing. So he doesn't delve into that realm, really.
But
and most of us don't as forensic pathologists unless we're pushed.
Right. And so, okay, so then your report, as you're brought in as a consultant on this, your report pushes that. What happens?
Well, Trish and I craft a letter together at my office, and we basically provide it to the Michigan State Police and the Attorney General's office, to the district attorney in that county, asking them to reopen the case and take another look at it.
And what did they tell you?
Well, I haven't the exact reply myself, but according to Trish, they refused to re-examine the case.
Just for people tuning in, Christy, will you re-identify who Trish is in this story?
Sure. Trish DeAngelis is a former district attorney in the state of New York. She had some involvement with some of the other cases, and I connected with her, and she feels as passionately about all of this as I do, and I would say we're working now on this as a team.
So the conclusion here is, and as you would describe it, Christy, is that this guy he was somewhere else for these number of days the night between he went missing at that party and when he's later on found in that lake, that there's somewhere else he was other than dead and in that water, correct?
That's right, and during that time when he was missing, his cell phone was not used, his credit cards were not used, he didn't call his family, and he was found wearing the same clothes that he was last seen in, except for his cell phone, and one of his shoes has never been recovered.
Okay, and so what is it that the family believes happened to Todd, to the boy that was missing?
They are at a loss just like everyone else. You have to imagine when they got this news from Dr. Sikorica how difficult it was for them to think about, okay, if he was missing and he wasn't dead, where was he? Who was doing what to him? why, I mean, there's so many questions. This has not been an easy project for them, and I give them so much credit for being strong enough and brave enough to go through it and to really want answers because they think it could help other people. But they don't know. They have no idea.
Was there anything in the local examiner's report about any potential harm that had been done to Todd's body before they found him?
No, the only odd thing that happened is that at the end of June, so this is back when they didn't know where he was, the family hadn't heard from him, they were looking everywhere for him. The law enforcement released some information to the public and went to the family and said that based on some rumors, they believed that Todd was dead, and they thought that he was hit by a car and buried in a shallow grave. And they told the family that at the end of June, and that's reported in newspaper articles, and the newspaper articles and that letter that the Michigan authorities sent to Trish and to Dr. Sikorica and to the family is all posted on my website. So you can see and read all that for yourself.
Okay, and I definitely want to get back to that. And so Dr. Sikorica, there's nothing in this body's condition that leads you to believe that he'd been hit by a car, buried in a shallow grave, taken out of the shallow grave, and then put in the water.
No, absolutely not. There was no traumatic injury at all. Noted by the pathologist at the autopsy. It was a very straightforward autopsy, well done. Didn't find any evidence of trauma.
And so what's your conclusion, Dr. Sikorica, as you look at this, what is it that you think happened to this guy? Any idea? An instinct after years of investigation? Anything?
Well, I've performed about 8,000 autopsies in my career so far, and this is one of the most strangest, bizarre cases I think I've seen. I don't know where he was or what he was doing for that length of time, whether he could be held captive, whether he could be off on his own for some reason. I just don't know.
But it doesn't, whatever it is, there's more there to be investigated, and the proper authorities in Michigan just aren't doing it.
They feel that they have done everything they can do, and they refuse to open the case. And it's not uncommon for a police agency to feel they've done everything and close the case when they've completed their work.
Christy, what do you think should be done next?
I think that someone should tell the family what happened to him. If he didn't get into that water on his own accord, that means that someone out there did something to him. And I think that after talking with his family and knowing more about Todd, I don't think that he would, take a swim or whatever. And his blood alcohol, which we haven't mentioned yet, was 0.12. So he wasn't overly intoxicated to the point that he couldn't. He was a strong swimmer, had saved his dog at one point in a lake. So he was familiar with water. So I think that law enforcement, I think that the people in Michigan should demand some answers. And there's contact information for the prosecutor, the only person in the county who can reopen that case. And the reason that I think that this is a case that should be looked at is not only for Todd's family, but that same night in another state, another young man went missing, also found in water. Are they connected? We don't know. But someone in law enforcement should maybe find that out.
Okay. Well, I think Dr. Michael Sikorica, you did a fabulous job here. And I think we got everything from you that we needed to better understand this case. Christy, I'm going to ask you if you can hang on past the top of the hour. I want to find out what other story, what other case like this have you investigated? What if you can start to put some of these cases together, what you think might be happening, who do you think will be a profile of the person that might be involved in a disappearance of somebody like this young man, Todd? And Dr. Michael Sikorica, thank you for your time, and also thank you for your ongoing efforts to help investigations like this, to give hope to families that they have a way of trying to get past when a local, sometimes political, but just overburdened bureaucratic agency doesn't have the time to put into it. It's nice to know that somebody out there at your level is willing to take a look at it. So thank you so much tonight and for giving us the time.
Thank you, Ian.
Keep up the good work.
Thank you.
Dr. Michael Sikorica. All right, so then hang on. We're going to continue this with Christy Peel after the top of the hour. She said that night somebody else went missing. So as she's been working in this with a stack of files, along with the former state's attorney from New York, working with other investigators on this case. If she were to put together a profile of who is doing this and what is happening, what is her instinct? What is the conclusion of these informed experts that with whom she's spoken? What conclusion are they coming to? Coming up next on Coast to Coast, this is Ian Ponet.